I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall, with the Midday News Wrap. President Donald Trump and Rocket Man are set to meet face-to-face this spring. Kim Jong-un has agreed to talks with Trump following years of harsh sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Frustrations continue for DACA recipients as congressional inaction sees the deadline date for the program that protects thousands of undocumented immigrants pushed back to the 23rd of March. The Baltimore Metro subway reopens after shutting down for emergency repairs for over 3 weeks and leaving thousands in the city without transportation to school or work. Also this hour, internationally acclaimed classical guitarist Lily Afshar will be playing some of her works live in Studio A. Lily will be performing a program of music at UMBC's Linehan Hall on Saturday at 8 p.m. in association with the Baltimore Classical Guitar Society. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Tom Hall. President Trump is set to make history as the first sitting U.S. president to meet with North Korea. It was North Korean leader Kim Jong-un who proposed the meeting with the president. This will be the first time the reclusive North Korean dictator meets with another head of state. President Trump imposed stiff tariffs yesterday, raising levies on imported steel by 25% and 10% on aluminum. The EU responded in kind, rolling out its own plan to impose tariffs on American-made goods. Former President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle are currently in negotiations with Netflix to produce exclusive content for the global streaming company. And yesterday in a federal courtroom, Trump's former campaign chairman Paul Manafort pled not guilty to charges of tax fraud, bank fraud, and conspiracy. We will be talking about some of these things this hour with David Smith, Washington bureau chief for The Garden. He'll be joining us from NPR studios in D.C. Right now, we're joined by Elena Schneider, a campaign pro reporter for Politico who focuses on House and Senate races. Elena, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we welcome your voices, too. Of course, you can give us a call at 410-662-8780 or email us at midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. So much to talk about today. Let's start, though, with Tuesday's Texas primaries, which saw high voter turnout but offered up very few overall surprises, with Republicans retaining their dominance across the state. Elena, tell us what happened in Texas.
So we saw what we've seen in Virginia, in New Jersey, in state special elections all across the country throughout 2017, which is that Democrats are excited to vote. They about doubled their numbers of participation in, since 2014, the last midterm election year. And this is just proof, once again, that Democrats are excited to get out there and vote in a midterm cycle when traditionally they've had a tougher time of getting out their constituencies. But as you said, overall, Republicans still had about 500,000 more voters come out on primary day. So it's still evidence that Texas is going to probably remain a red state.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think Texas, unlike Maryland, is an open primary state. Is that right?
I don't think so. I think you do actually have to vote in the primary in which you're registered.
But if you're a registered independent, do you have to sit at home and sit on your hands and just watch?
You know, to be honest, I do not have that information in front of me, but
I wasn't completely positive on it. Obviously, here in Maryland, we're a closed primary state, so there's a huge tranche of voters that don't get a chance to say anything in the primary. So things can always change in the general significantly once those independents can be factored in. But that may or may not be an issue in Texas. Still, Texas has a huge Republican voter advantage.
That's right. At this point, it's still pretty clear that Republicans are going to hold on to offices statewide. That's not to say that Beto O'Rourke, the Democrat who's planning to challenge Ted Cruz in the Senate race there, it's not to say that he won't be able to get a solid showing and is going to get huge financial support from online donors both in Texas but then all across the country who have been really captured by him.
And I'm getting a note, Texas is indeed an open primary state, so there's no folks who didn't get a chance to vote because they weren't registered properly to do that.
Understood. too many state laws floating around in my head right now.
So in the Texas primaries, back to that, some well-funded Democrats ended up losing, those with establishment ties.
So that's correct. There was about three Democrats who were incredibly well-funded in their bids. So these are people who raised at least about $1 million for a House race in a primary, which is a significant chunk of money. These are places like Dallas and Houston. but they weren't able to get, not only were not able to win, but in Texas, you have to reach a 50% threshold to win a primary. And so if you don't reach that threshold, if no one reaches that, it goes on to a runoff. So not only were these well-funded candidates unable to get into the first place, they didn't even make it into the runoff. So they weren't even then in the top two. And it's been really fascinating to sort of watch people start to diagnose what might have been the issues. But one evident answer is that if you're a person of color and if you're a woman, you're really answering to the electorate right now and giving a reason for people to vote for you just simply by who you are.
Did we see progressive candidates do well in the Democratic side and vice versa? How did more conservative candidates do on the Republican side?
Well, on the Republican side, it's still very much there's not a lot of daylight amongst the Republican candidates. So there was 8 Republican members of Congress who, in safer seats, tends to be redder seats, that have decided to not seek re-election this cycle. So those were all open primaries, lots of candidates in them, and for the most part, we didn't see a lot of policy distinctions. And again, some of that may start to emerge as we head into the runoff, and it's a head-to-head race. Most people, though, were really pushing on agree that they support Trump, agree that they support a wall and immigration plans that the Republicans have put forward. So not a lot of daylight, much more about personality on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, we did see some interesting results as far as progressives go. One place that comes to mind is in Houston, a battleground seat where Democrats really hope to flip this cycle in the general election, because it's a traditional sort of Romney district, suburban, well-educated, pretty affluent. And Hillary Clinton won it by about 1.5 points in 2016. So Democrats really see this as a top target. And the two Democrats who made it into the runoff, one is sort of more traditional, as you say, more of an establishment candidate, has really sort of presented herself as sort of a Hillary Clinton, very focused on Planned Parenthood. And then we've got another, Laura Moser, who is a very progressive, somebody who national Democrats were concerned might be too liberal for the district and had some baggage. And they tried to drop some opposition research on her, and in fact, it didn't work. She managed to get through to the primary. And so it's clear that, in Houston and in a couple of other places, that progressive candidates did do well.
You're calling us, or rather we called you, but you're in Pennsylvania right now because we've got a special election coming up there next week. Tell us what's going on.
So we've got a really exciting special election that isn't going to mean a whole lot in just a couple of months. So it's a special election to replace Tim Murphy, a congressman, a Republican congressman who's represented the area for almost 2 decades. And he was decided to resign over some sexual misconduct, an affair, abortion. Anyways, it's too much to get into right now, but he decided to resign. And there's a special election to replace him. Connor Lamb is the Democrat who's running here. He's a sort of classic blue dog Democrat, somebody who is supportive of Second Amendment rights, presents himself, former federal prosecutor, and he cuts a very sort of persuasive profile here in Western Pennsylvania. And the Republican who's running has really lagged in fundraising, isn't a particularly compelling person, is a veteran himself, but is someone who Republicans are really concerned about, is just not a good candidate. And so this race is certainly going to test some of the Trump intensity. This is Trump district. Trump won it by 20 points in 2016. So the fact that Democrats think that there's even a chance that they might be able to flip it is significant and tells us a lot about where we may be headed in 2018. But the little snag here is that it's unlikely, though, that this district will exist, because Pennsylvania's congressional map was ruled unconstitutional, and they're going to have to draw it ahead of the 2018 midterms. So in a couple of months, this district is going to look completely different. But nonetheless, Republicans and Democrats both really believe that this is going to be key to their narrative of getting people excited for the midterms.
The district's changing. So this is the last time this particular version of this district will likely have a representative?
That's right.
And then in May, they have to do it all over again.
Exactly. So they'll have to go through another set of primaries. It's possible that neither candidate will actually run for this area. Both of their sort of hometowns have been redistricted into other districts. So, like you said, it's a bit of a strange set of circumstances. But it's really about, for both sides, it's a way to get their bases excited. If Republicans can hold on to this, and walk away with a victory, they can feel like it's not totally lost potentially. But you know, on the flip side, Democrats, even if they get close to winning, they'll be able to point to this and say, look how far this district that backed Trump by 20 points swung in just 1 year. Look what we might be able to accomplish going forward.
Steel is big business in Pennsylvania. Is the Trump tariff decision announced yesterday playing into this race at all?
It's playing into it some. Both candidates have said that they would support a tariff. It's not totally clear yet. They haven't totally clarified their positions, though, on whether on Trump's plan specifically they support, which I know Trump's plan still is sort of a bit unclear at this point. But so far, it's both of them are broadly supportive of this idea because, as you noted, this is a steel sort of manufacturing part of the country, and they're going to be supportive of that.
Looking nationally, are there any candidates, any races we should be watching with all of the primaries that will be taking places over the next couple months?
Well, I think it's going to be really interesting to keep an eye on those suburban districts. What we talked about in Houston, in Dallas, it's tough out of Texas because those all are now going to, going to runoffs. But we've got Illinois in about 10 days. So we'll have a new slate of primaries there that will give us some answers as to what kind of Democrats come out of these suburban areas who hope to take on Republican incumbents in places where Hillary Clinton may have flipped the district back in 2016 and where Democrats hope to do it again in 18. But another really interesting one to watch is the Democratic primary out of Illinois, where Dan Lipinski, a blue dog Democrat, one of the few, if not the only, anti-abortion rights Democrat who is still in Congress, is trying to defend himself against a very progressive, pro-abortion rights woman who's challenging him in a primary. So that's going to be a really interesting one to watch to see if a blue dog Democrat, sort of classic conservative, socially conservative Democrat, can still survive in 2018.
And President Trump is probably going to be a big factor in these races, even if he's not on the ballot. How are Republicans messaging around Trump? Are they distancing themselves from him or getting themselves closer?
At this point, it's still the primaries. So a lot of candidates are still very much identifying themselves with Trump, depending on the district. So in some battleground districts where it's very divided, some members have certainly pointed out places where they are different from the president. Take Mike Kaufman, who's running in the Denver suburbs, Carlos Corbello in Miami, both Republican incumbents who have put some distance between themselves and the president because their districts are such battleground places. But in other districts where there's a bit more Trump popularity, Republican incumbents are concerned about alienating their base who support Trump, and they want those people to come out and vote in November. And so they're not going to put too much distance between themselves and the president because they don't want to alienate their base.
I keep hearing analysts talk about the potential of a Democratic wave this year. Is that something that's being borne out by anything you're seeing, anything you're hearing?
Well, it's certainly something that we are starting to see evidence of. So it's far too early to sort of declare one way or the other if it's coming. But we are seeing signs of what has shown in the past to be indicators of a wave. So one example, obviously, is turnout. So we saw it again in Texas. We've seen it in Virginia and in other state legislative special elections. The Democrats are excited to vote. So that's one piece of evidence. A second one is just fundraising. So last quarter, so to cover October to December, for Republican incumbents trying to raise money, about 43 of them were outraised by their Democratic challengers, which is a pretty staggering number, and that's actually an increase from the previous quarter, where about 36 were outraised by their Democratic opponents. So the money race is clearly showing that Democrats are not only are they excited to vote, they also want to give out of their own pocketbook to candidates that they believe in. And that's really significant in a midterm cycle when money does count and money does, in fact, help you get your message out, especially against an incumbent who may have been there for a number of years.
But money isn't always the deciding factor, as we saw in some races in Texas and, of course, President Trump versus Hillary Clinton.
That's right. You still have to have a message. You still have to have a good candidate who can deliver it authentically.
Elena Schneider is a campaign pro reporter for Politico with a focus on House and Senate races, and she's in Pennsylvania covering the special House election taking place on Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us, Elena.
Thanks so much for having me.
Quick break now, and then when we return, David Smith of the Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian will join us. We'll talk Trump and trade and Little Rocket Man. And we'll take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, midday at WYPR.org. Stick around. This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner in for Tom Hall this afternoon. Tom is back with us on Monday with the latest installment of our series of Conversations with the Candidates. Representative John Sarbanes will be live in Studio A discussing gun safety, the Bay Journal, and congressional action on DACA. That's Monday on Midday. Today, it's the news wrap, and I am joined now by The Guardian's David Smith on the line from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with North Korea. President Trump looking like he's going to have a high-profile meeting with Kim Jong-un sometime this spring. What do we know?
Well, yes, we know, I think, appealing to Donald Trump's sense of drama, that by May there will be some kind of meeting between him and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It will be historic, the first time the leaders of the two countries have met. We don't know exactly when or where, but it's naturally being portrayed by the Trump administration as a diplomatic triumph, saying that Kim has agreed to suspend the nuclear and ballistic missile program while it happens, although sanctions will certainly remain in place pending the outcome of these negotiations. What we really don't know is whether the United States will actually ultimately get anything from this. Certainly, some analysts are striking a note of caution. Wondering if Trump actually knows that North Korea has invited past U.S. presidents to talk, and they've all refused. There were some mutterings of perhaps Bill Clinton going towards the end of his term, but he concentrated on the Middle East peace process instead. And North Korea has made various promises over the years that have not been fulfilled. So I think there is some wariness that Trump might walk into a trap here, that perhaps his ego will be flattered, and that actually not much will come of it. So we'll have to see.
We will have to see. Do you think that... I feel like President Trump speaks a lot on Twitter off the cuff. Is there a chance that he's going to kibosh this whole thing? He's insulted Kim Jong-un many, many times in the past.
Yes, the meeting might not even happen. Let's face it. There could be all sorts of hiccups and breakdowns over everything from Trump on the spur of the moment sending out an undiplomatic tweet to Kim, who is arguably just as volatile and egotistical, deciding to carry out a missile test after all and call America's bluff and perhaps try and humiliate the administration. Or indeed, there could be a breakdown over the logistics of, where are they actually going to meet? Because both Pyongyang and Washington seem pretty unlikely, as it would give one leader or the other home territory. So,
and no one wants to cede that advantage.
Well, indeed, the idea of the American president being in a photo opportunity in North Korea and the propaganda that would hand to Kim. Seems pretty unthinkable. At the same time, the idea of Kim at the White House or dare I say at Mar-a-Lago, where we know Trump has enjoyed entertaining leaders from China and Japan and elsewhere, that also seems pretty unthinkable. So I guess they'll try to find neutral territory. All this needs to be worked out before it actually happens.
Assuming it does happen at all. Let's move on to tariffs. As he said he would do last week, Trump moved forward yesterday with a plan to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. 10% tariff on aluminum, 25% on steel. These are set to kick in 15 days. A change, though, from his original plan. They will not be for everyone, at least not for the start. Canada and Mexico temporarily exempted. Why is that?
I think diplomatically it would have been a nightmare to hit Canada and Mexico straight away, and you know, he has a get out clause there with NAFTA. That was one of the first concessions he made on this, really, to say, look, we're still negotiating NAFTA. If we get a good deal, then there's no need to worry about these tariffs. So that gives a good get-out clause, and there's no real time limit on that. When you consider the closeness of the relationship on security matters and others with Canada, imposing these tariffs would have gone down very badly indeed. There's also been some talk of perhaps Australia being exempt because it does actually have a trade deficit with the US unusually. I'm sure various other allies will be queuing up to make their case as well. So overall, these tariffs are less sweeping and less harsh than initially suggested. But even so, there remains the risk of a global trade war.
I read that bit about Australia, that it might be exempted, and that has me confused. So they're moving forward with the tariffs, but they don't yet really know all who they're moving forward with the tariffs about, if exemptions are still possible?
Indeed, and Trump has been at pains to say, I'm going to judge it on a country-by-country basis and a case-by-case basis, and that perhaps some countries will be exempt altogether, and others he may tweak the percentage, as you mentioned, sort of 25 and 10%. That could go higher and lower as well, which frankly is getting into the sort of territory his advisors had said he wants to avoid. Over the weekend, Peter Navarro was saying on CNN, look, if you exempt one country, then you quickly get on a slippery slope, and everybody wants an exemption, or you know, those countries not exempt end up with an even higher tariff. But it seems, you know, just the outcry of opposition to this move, not only from the European Union and Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal and all sorts of financial commentators, but from Trump's own Republican Party, has had some sort of impact and made him water it down from what he originally intended.
And so the 25 and 10% tariff things aren't even necessarily real. He's going to go through and make up something for each country that we deal with, possibly?
Well, you know how it began, that certainly according to media reports, the original suggestion was 24%. And then he said, well, 25% is a more rounded figure, so let's go for that. Yes, there seems to be quite a lot of wiggle room on the 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. However, I think those are the baseline figures. I think we should probably still assume that in most cases, those are the numbers to be applied. But however, you know, with some flexibility. And if you were cynical about this, you would suspect, you know, he's had his White House event to announce these to try and fire up his base and say that he's bringing back jobs for the steel industry and so on. But then much more quietly, much more behind the scenes, with far less media coverage, perhaps some of these exemptions and these different percentages will be applied.
Assuming these things do go into effect, what about the WTO? What could happen to them? Are they going to stand?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if China and or the European Union lodge a complaint with the World Trade Organization, and that is certainly possible. There have been some questions asked about would the United States consider walking away from the WTO, and certainly the interviews I've seen with administration officials, they've been ducking and diving on that question and not really wanting to give a straight answer. In addition to that, of course, China and the EU could retaliate with some trade tariffs of their own, and certainly the European Union have been quite outspoken about that already on everything from bed linen to cranberry to orange juice to Harley Davidson motorcycles and various other things. Some products, or most of the products, very interestingly, seemingly targeted in key states in the U.S., either swing states in elections or the states of Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. So whether that's a coincidence or not, or just some canny targeting by the EU, leave to you.
I think they've even admitted that's some canny targeting, actually.
Right.
But the many Republicans in Congress have been opposed to the trade plan. What are the ramifications of this for Trump's dealing with Congress, dealing with his own party?
I think this is one of the interesting aspects of the big picture here, that Donald Trump is not noted as a man of strong ideological convictions. I know he's a former Democrat, and many would say just makes things up on the spur of the moment, including the North Korean talks. And yet, at yesterday's White House event, he emphasized again that this particular belief in protectionism, in protecting the U.S. against foreign trade, what he says, countries taking advantage of us, is something that long predates his political career. It goes back sort of 20 or 30 years. And like him or loathe him, you could argue this is one instance where he is being true to himself and fulfilling a campaign promise he made during the election. But as you say, and as we remember from that election, it does put him deeply at odds with the Republican Party. And that's also been interesting that after a year in which the Republicans just seem to accept and go along with whatever he throws at them and cling to the consolations of judicial appointments and tax cuts and so on, this time Paul Ryan and other Republicans are finally speaking out, and more than 100 wrote a letter objecting to these tariffs. It is an ideological split, and it does raise questions over the midterms, even the presidential election. Are we seeing finally some gap, some distance between Trump and the Republican Party?
And within his White House too, the resignation of Gary Cohn was probably related to this.
Oh, absolutely. Gary Cohn, seen as part of that faction in the White House, the so-called Goldman Sachs, Wall Street globalist tendency, who had been arguing against this and worked hard on the tax cuts, and have been ideologically opposed to the faction that was represented by Steve Bannon, and still has a flag bearer in Stephen Miller, who of course are the so-called economic nationalists, and certainly will be celebrating this particular move. So I think it was the straw that broke the camel's back for Gary Cohn. As you say, he's not alone, probably in the White House, opposing it.
Will that have further implications for the way White House deals with trade issues in the future, Cohen's departure?
Yeah, I think the likes of Miller and Peter Navarro and others are clearly in the ascendant, but perhaps more importantly, it's indicative of how Trump is increasingly isolated and acting unilaterally, because the bottom line is it's just now an extraordinary turnover at the White House. Somewhat the Brookings Institution calculated 43% staff turnover, much higher than Barack Obama or George W. Bush had. And if you remember last week, which in Trump time feels like an eternity ago, communications director Hope Hicks left. Others have gone as well, many names over the last year or so. And I think many articles are being written, including by me, which sort of theorize that without those voices of constraint, without those safety valves, Trump is sort of reverting to his true self and following his impulses. It's governance by gut instinct, and many would argue that's probably not a healthy thing.
Should these tariffs kick in, they could have some big effects on our economy. There was a story on Morning Edition today about Brazil reacting very negatively to them. Brazil sends us steel, and it buys a lot of coal from us to make the steel, which it may not buy from us if it has to pay these tariffs. So these could end up really doing a lot of changes, and making a lot of changes to the way our economy functions, right?
That's right. I mean, it because you know, it all sounds quite abstract and theoretical. And Stephen Colbert was joking on his show last night about you know, sort of trade tariffs yawn as it's just such an unsexy subject in many ways. But you know, the point is, this could have a real impact on people's everyday lives and ultimately a knock-on effect on the prices of goods and a lot of job losses potentially. And you know, critics would say Trump is bending over backwards to protect, I think the estimate is you know, 170,000 jobs in the steel industry, but actually way more than that could be affected. And that would be a terrible setback on a day when there's been another very positive jobs report. I think the biggest job increase for a year and a half. A lot is being said and written about how the economy is thriving at the moment. And there would obviously be political dispute over whether that's been helped or not by the tax cuts, or whether a lot of it is inherited from the Obama administration. But in either case, it would be a terrible blow, clearly, if a lot of that success was derailed because of this move. And clearly, everyone from Gary Cohen to the Wall Street Journal to Paul Ryan to many others really, really do fear that Trump is going to shoot himself in the foot and you know, undermine that economic success. And we all know, obviously, that could have implications for him at the ballot box.
Before I let you go, I want to travel way, way back in time, Trump time, as you said, to Monday, the day that the DACA program was set to end. Where does DACA stand now?
In utter limbo, it would seem. The court ruling, which meant DACA put on hold, was really gave a get out for members of Congress who, let's face it, at the best of times are you know, are not noted for their fast decision making and ability to work across the aisle. So you know, the big losers are many of those people who came to America as children, undocumented, and are waiting to find out their fate. Now they just remain on edge, just not quite sure what's going to happen. I mean, even Trump has been tweeting saying, you know, Democrats have stopped talking about DACA. I don't think the Democrats would agree with that, but it does perhaps touch on a wider issue that, with concern obviously about gun control as well, DACA has sadly fallen down the agenda. And of course, you know, in the media, we're already talking about North Korea, and let's not forget, you know, Stormy Daniels, the former pornographic actress who claims she had an affair with Trump a decade ago.
But back to DACA, how do you have any perspectives to how that's going to affect the upcoming elections, both the primaries and the generals? Because at this point, it's in legal limbo. I mean, for the people who are not the DACA recipients, who are just in a permanent state of crazed limbo over what's going to happen, we don't really know what's going to happen with this program, and it's going to stretch out months before the courts probably rule.
That's right. And I think there'll be certain internal pressures with Trump and the Republican Party. But perhaps the more interesting dynamic will be on the Democratic side, where, you know, we've seen for some time now an ongoing debate within in the left between sort of more centrist mainstream Democrats and those to the left of them. And you know, during the government shutdown and the various votes that we've had, there has certainly been strong criticism of Chuck Schumer and others for selling out, for not taking a tough enough stand to protect DACA, and now with the issue just left on the boil, one would imagine that will bleed into some of these Democratic primaries and the elections themselves. That you know, it will be one of those rallying points, those issues. You know, where do you stand on DACA? How far are you willing to go to protect immigrants? Or, you know, are you more likely to sort of toe the party line? So I think it'll be, it'll be fascinating to see how that plays out.
Do you think there is any chance whatsoever that Congress is going to step in and try to deal with DACA again?
I would hesitate to predict. I think, you know, clearly there's certainly a chance, but right now it does appear to be quite a low priority. Sort of human nature is writ large that you procrastinate and you kick the can down the road to the last possible minute. And that's true if you're a kid at school who's got a hand in his homework and do it the last minute. Or I think if you're a politician left to confront an issue, sadly, there just does not seem to be the urgency there. I think because as with gun control, it just does seem such an intractable problem where there's so little overlap and so little room for agreement, and perhaps the midterm elections will shake things up a bit.
David Smith is the Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, David.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break here on Your Public Radio, a live performance by Persian classical guitarist Lily Ashfar, right here in Studio A. You're listening to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall. Stick around.